Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Azucena Carrasco coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mengeen, Brisbane. And today on the show...
We know that, you know, like in regards to Indigenous protected areas, they're significantly underfunded compared to other protected areas and within our national estate.
Environment organisations are asking the federal government to consider the environment a critical economic asset. We have all the details. Also, how much has Brisbane grown and what does it mean for its community? And later today...
I've got the Greg Norman tournament that I'm preparing for and the Gary Player. I've got an Australian, a US Kids Golf Australian Open that's coming up as well. Also, got the German Masters.
A young golf player is becoming more popular and now he's calling Australia home. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We are on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today. Yesterday, The Wire covered the story of Minister Mark Butler's announcement of the Thriving Kids program to become part of the foundational support. Advocates and organizations have slammed the decision, saying some children will be left out without support. Lee Smith is a mother of an autistic child and says that she was not impressed with this decision. Powered Media's Emma Myers asked Mrs. Smith her thoughts on the announcement.
I was stunned and then thinking, why am I surprised? This is the way they've been cutting plans and treating people with disability for a long time. Still, every time that one of these big announcements happens, it still kicks you in the guts. Your rational brain's telling you this can't be happening. Then they go ahead and make decisions without consulting people with disability, just ignoring the evidence, just to save money, which they will end up having to spend more in the long term by not supporting these kids.
What are your top priorities in taking care of your son, and how will this new announcement impact that?
The top priority right now is getting him to school, because academically he is thriving in a mainstream school, but socially and emotionally he's struggling, and the school finds it hard to understand that he can be high achieving in some areas and need a lot of support in others. And he's not toilet trained and he's 10 years old. So developmentally, the age most kids achieve that goal is like 3.5 years old. And without NDIS support, it's likely that he'll drop out of mainstream school. And I see one of two things happening. Either he goes to a special school and then his academics suffer because they'll be focusing on his social and emotional well-being, but not be able to provide the academic support that he deserves. Or I homeschool him, which means I have to stop working, and the trajectory for his life will be impacted. My son has the ability to graduate from school, to get employment and everything, but only if he has the supports to do it.
What do you think about this new program and the fact that they have a rollout deadline of the 1st of July next year, considering we're still waiting for foundational support?
It's exactly like the NDIS pilot. They're flying the plane before it's finished being built, announcing the name of the program, Thriving Kids, before they even know what it's going to be. It's all just an effort for them to save money in the short term, but they don't care about the human cost of that.
How do you think that the Thriving Kids support system will be different to what you're getting now?
Well, I guess in one sense it's hard to say because they haven't provided enough detail about the program to be able to make an informed decision about it. But from what I do know, it's not going to be the same quality and level of support that he currently receives. They're talking about programs like Inklings and parent sessions. So basically saying that, I'll do 10 parent sessions and my son's autism will be cured. That is so incredibly insulting to my child, to me. Basically saying if I was a better parent, he wouldn't be disabled. We had a team meeting yesterday and we were reflecting on all the successes he's made with NDIS therapy and then the challenges that he's still got to overcome. And then an announcement like this just makes me think that all the progress he's made is going to be lost and that, he's not going to continue to make progress and be able to go to a mainstream school and graduate and get a job. That's all I want.
How would you define mild to moderate autism?
It's really insulting to use those terms because they're not even diagnostically valid. He has some areas that he doesn't need a lot of supports in, and others that he needs a lot. The NDIS is supposed to be about assessing each child and person individually as to what they need functionally to live a good life. It's not supposed to be based on your diagnosis. The fact that he's saying that autism is lifelong, neurodivergent can't be outgrown with short-term therapy or parent sessions. The implication that autistic children are less than other children is just shocking. And when he said, in his opinion, the children with mild and moderate autism shouldn't be on the scheme, what gives him the right to make that decision? What qualifications does he have? Does he have a PhD in neurodevelopmental disabilities? They're making all of these announcements and changes without proper consultation with the autistic community.
Madalie Smith there, speaking with Powered Media's Emma Myers. Powered Media received a written statement from Minister Mark Butler, and it's on our website on thewire.org.au.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's national current affairs program.
Union chiefs, bureaucrats and business leaders were all under the same roof last week, speaking to the federal government on the best way to boost productivity. This means gaining the most out of the work we do every day, including the quality of our work and how much we get done in a wide array of topics, such as tax, housing, AI, construction, and the environment. Before the discussions began, around 20 of Australia's environment organisations call on the federal government to recognise the environment as a critical economic asset. National Indigenous Radio Services reporter Harrison Pedersen started asking CEO of the North Australian Indigenous Land and Sea Management Alliance, Barry Hunter, about the joint statement to the federal government.
Yeah, so it's about environmental organisations coming together and the communique and the key messages are that, number one, government should phase out taxpayer subsidies that harm nature, like burning of fossil fuels and invest in things such as regenerative economies that build our ecosystem and long-term prosperity, particularly around biodiversity.
Absolutely. And so, from what you've seen on the ground, what has government in action meant for when it comes to, caring for country?
Well, in terms of Indigenous people, and it's not so much the inaction, it's the underwhelming support for some of those actions. So we know that, in regards to Indigenous protected areas, they're significantly underfunded compared to other protected areas and within our national estate. So, per hectare, where the amount of money that might go into on a national park, such as Uluru or Kakadu, is vastly different and considerably less that might go into an Indigenous protected area. And for Indigenous rangers, this means that there's a real consideration of whether they literally run equipment or go out and do resource work. And the resource work I speak of, that's fire management, weeds management, feral management, rehabilitation work. So yeah, there's a real discrepancy in between the funding levels there.
How have the, you know, governments, either like, you know, territory and federal, how have they been in terms of, like, you know, listening to, you know, your perspective and kind of what rangers are saying on the ground?
Yeah, well, we saw the Northern Territory government get rid of the Northern Territory Indigenous Ranger grants, you know, which was a $12 million funded, $12 million funded program. And the new territory government chose not to renew that, which is very disappointing because that's money paid for a whole range of equipment and essential support in regards to the day-to-day work that Indigenous Rangers do in the Northern Territory. So that's one aspect. And I guess, you know, like what I was going back to before, that the Indigenous protected area is significantly underfunded. And on the other hand, the government wants to increase the ranger numbers, which is great. At first reflection, it looks like a real good story. And by 2030, they're going to double the ranger numbers that were around in 2025. And that's a great, great election promise. But the problem with it is that it's seen as a jobs program. So as it rolls out, the rangers go into these roles, but yet they won't have the basic equipment or the basic resources to be able to go out and do the work that they need to do. So it's fundamentally, there's things that need to change within government policy and government process in order to address that.
CEO of the North Australian Indigenous Land and Sea Management Alliance, Barry Hunter, there, speaking with National Indigenous Radio Services' Harrison Pedersen. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Azucena Carrasco in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on ACCC, to our listeners in Taree on 2Bob Radio, and to the other side of the country, to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. Brisbane's economy has officially surged past $200 billion for the first time, marking a remarkable 16% growth over just 4 years. Record jobs, booming investment, and a thriving experience economy are transforming the city into one of the fastest growing urban economies in Australia and the Asia Pacific. But what does it mean for residents, local businesses, and the city's future as it prepares for the Olympics and Paralympics in 2032? I spoke with CEO of the Brisbane Economic Development Agency, Anthony Ryan, to find out more.
The State of the City announced that for the first time, that $200 billion for our GRP, it's a line in the sand that says that as a city, we are now getting into the territory of a very vibrant, flourishing, well-credentialed economy. So it's not strength in one particular area, it's strength right across the board. And we identified that there were various reasons or various sectors that allowed Brisbane to be seen as a very active and exciting economy where you should invest and where business growth can take place. So professional services, we will grow between up to 50% between now and 2031. Our advanced manufacturing, we project about an increase of about 36 to 37% during that time. And these are all signs that our city is putting on the show that people want to invest, people want to grow their businesses here. It also shows that we have had strong population growth since 2020, and in particular, strong employment growth. When we've looked at, there's been over 276,000 new jobs placed into the economy. And so that's all good news, but we also understand that that comes with growing pains as well, and we are not blind to those. We are working with the greatest thinkers and all sectors to work out how we can actually have great growth, but also understand how we can move forward with those challenges. Certainly, we were at 100% capacity. All our hotels and restaurants were full. But the advantage that Southeast Queensland has as a community of different tourism offerings. We also have a lot of the tourists staying at the Gold Coast, at the Sunshine Coast. So we certainly had great capacity here in Brisbane, but we also were able to utilise that, and Sunshine Coast and Gold Coast did very well over Blue-Cyrus Line. The restaurants, the cafes, mm-hmm. the precincts are certainly not over capacity. They're certainly thriving and loving the added demand in Brisbane as a tourist destination.
So it's a great moment for small businesses in the city and even beyond the city of Brisbane. Is that right?
Yeah, what we're seeing is, Brisbane, if you look at the demographic of our city, over 90% of businesses are small businesses. So we would define small business up to 20 people within 20 employees. And where we're seeing great examples of growth, like Mulfana as a commercial cleaning and landscaping and building services, it's a First Nations business that is now really benefiting from this growth. And if you look at Black Clash, they're a design agency that ensure First Nations perspectives are brought into built environments through things like artwork. That is flourishing. Uatua's, it's a First Nations experience on North Stradbroke Island. What's really happening there, it's allowing North Stradbroke to really imagine a new tourist offerings. And we're seeing that Southeast Queensland is now being defined as the best of Australia in the one tourism spot. And so what used to happen with business investment and tourism is people would land in Brisbane and then they would go to the Gold Coast or the Cairns or Sunshine Coast. They would just see this as the landing spot. Mm-hmm. Now we're seeing that we've got so much offering, so much diversity in our precincts like Howardsmith Wharf, South Bank, James Street, Queens Wharf, Fish Lane. We've got all these different parts of the city have these very vibrant, wonderful personalities. And then we have a 50-cent, get around the city with 50 cents. That mm-hmm. was the feedback that we're getting from tourists is mm-hmm. it's a walkable city, it's a very livable, beautiful city, but it's also from a transport and accessibility, it's a great offering.
Excellent. That's definitely bringing a lot of the conversation around the how we can incentivize the tourism industry. But back to the 2032 games on the horizon, and with so many billions in infrastructure investment, etc. How does Brisbane's performance compare to other Olympic host cities around the world? For example, Sydney or Barcelona.
Yeah, well, as you know, we're 7 years out now and we're on our own journey. What I know that the work that BIDA does with key Olympic organising leaders from the Brisbane 2032 organising committee right through to the GICA infrastructure committee, our interactions with those are saying that we certainly don't need to be like Sydney, we certainly don't need to be like Barcelona, but we can learn valuable lessons. So we're running our own race.
That was CEO of the Brisbane Economic Development Agency, Anthony Ryan. You can find the Brisbane Economic Development Agency's full report in our website, thewire.org.au. An emerging golf player is in Australia hoping to become one of the best players across the world. South African Damian Servas is becoming a trend on social media because of his performance in overseas tournaments. With only 11 years of age, Damian has been invited to the US again and to Spain to compete in junior golf. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan started asking Damian about his favourite hobbies and how he started golfing.
My favourite hobby is golf, and I love about Australia is that good food, nice views at my house, and good golf courses.
And what about the beach? Do you like the beaches here, or are they better back home?
They're pretty good here. They're all right.
Yeah, they're okay, I guess. Yeah. Fair enough. Cool, cool. And what would you like to study when you grow up?
I want to study law so I can get, even if my golf doesn't work, I've got law so then I can, you know, then it's all good, basically.
Fantastic. And you want to study here? Would you like to go back home? Or
I want to study in America.
In the U.S.?
In the U.S., yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Damien, how did you get interested in golf? I mean, you're 11 years old. I was playing video games at that time, I remember. What's about it that attracts you as a sport?
I started off when I was 7 at Balville Golf Club, and I remember my dad took me and just to go chip, and I chipped pretty good, and then I started to love the game since then, and my dad just pulled me in to play golf, and now I love it.
So your dad was the one who introduced you to golf, and he taught you some...
Yeah, he taught me everything what to do when I started.
Oh, fantastic. Well done. And what has been the best memory of golf so far from your short but emerging career?
My best memory, I was in Cape Town. I was playing. I was actually one behind my friend, one of my friends. We went to the last hole, and I hit a great drive. My friend, he hits it. He was 2 years older than me. He hits it way further than me. I hit a great drive. Hit my second shot in the bunker. He hits it in the middle of the green, which is like basically a better than being in the bunker. And my dad told me, you know, just get it out, make your par, or even a bogey. And my mom was sitting, there was a big window and we could see the last hole. And my mom was watching there. She even filmed it. I was there. I was just like, let me get out of this big bunker. And then I hit a great shot. I made the shot and I won by one. So that's what really helped me. And yeah, it was very fun that moment.
All right. And can you please just tell us a little bit more about the tournaments that you've been? Which countries have you visited and how many tournaments you've been doing over these 4 years?
Yeah. So I've been to America twice, actually. I just came back from America.
How was it?
Fun. It was very fun.
Cool.
I've been to America. I've been to Italy, France, England, South Africa, and Australia.
Cool. Damien, let's say I just want to become a golf player and I'm hiring you for training me. What are your best tips to become a great golf player?
You know, grip it and rip it. Just... Yeah, have fun, because, yeah, it's a very nice sport. Keep your head down and practice.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
All right, that's a great tip. Any other tips that you would like to share?
That's it, basically.
That's
it? Practice. Practice makes perfect.
So you were saying that you and your family are from South Africa. Just tell us a little bit more about Cape Town and what do you miss the most from it?
I miss my friends from Cape Town and... The golf courses are there, very good, and yeah, that's basically it. Everything else is pretty normal to here, but yeah.
And what do your friends tell you about you moving to Australia and then that you're participating on these international competitions, I mean?
Yeah, so when I'm used to different schools in Cape Town, just before I left, and I told all my friends that I was going to move to Australia, and they're all like, oh, there's going to be snakes in the toilet and stuff like that.
Love it. Uh-huh.
And I'm like, what? That's not true. I've been here before. And they were like, what? But then now I speak to them sometimes on Instagram.
And speaking of Instagram and social media, I checked out your Instagram and you have more than 10,000 followers. Number one, congratulations. What do you usually post there and how do you do it and where can people follow you?
So, first of all, my dad runs my Instagram, so he does everything with that. And you guys can follow me on Instagram, Damien Zervas.
That was junior golf player Damien Zervas. To find out more about his future events, go to our website at thewire.org.au. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Melbourne and Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. If you would like to listen to any of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au and check us out on Facebook and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Jagera countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Mengeen, Brisbane. I'm Azucena Carrasco. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.